posters around abolition, you know, ending slavery, etc., etc. It is a fascinating opportunity, and I would say, unfortunately, a timely one in the sense of how prescient the topic was and is. We ended the event with some words from Frederick Douglass. They were delivered by actor Ian Gray. So I have the pleasure today of sharing with you my Q&A. Basically, it was an in-chat conversation, a virtual conversation like they all are these days with Christine. Really honoured, as I said, to draw attention to this new book by Routledge. It's available through the Routledge website if anyone wants to find out more information about it, and it's called Black Abolitionists in Ireland, and we're going to go straight from that then into hearing from Frederick Douglass, an 1865 speech from Ian Gray. Thanks, folks.
Okay, Christine, so we're on. You can see me and I can see you, and I hope the line is good for everybody. And I'd like to start off, first of all, Christine, thank you for being here today. I know you have a busy week, and it's always a pleasure to have an opportunity to interact with you in this way. And congratulations on another publication to the list.
Okay, thank you. And as you say, I haven't seen it, but I do have a pen. So I have no book, but I have a pen.
Okay.
Can I just say at the outset, I really want to echo the sentiments expressed by you and by Ciarán, because this has been a very tough time to be living in the United States. But let's hope it is a watershed moment, but for the better.
So, Christine, you profile 10 abolitionists in the book. And I'm going to take a moment to give their names. Odawalla Aquino, I think he's quite relatively well known. Some of the others in between, maybe less so. Moses Roper, Charles Lennox Remond, Frederick Douglass, we do know him, William Wells Brown, Henry Highland Garnett, Edmund Kelly, Samuel Ringold Ward, Benjamin Benson, and Sarah Parker Redmond. And they're the 10 that you profile, and we'll talk a little bit about the wider context. But I know there are people on the line who are very familiar with your work, but there are some people here today who won't be quite as familiar. Can you tell me a little bit about how you came to this topic, and maybe in the context of us not assuming in the way that you and I would be so familiar with maybe the name of Daniel O'Connell and the position of Ireland within Britain. I'm not asking you to give a big long lecture on it, but just for people who don't know how you came into this and that kind of wider context, just so people have an idea as to the background.
Okay, thank you, Miriam. So some people might know me for my work on Ireland's Great Hunger, or as we tend to call it in Ireland, the Great Irish Famine. And I did my PhD essentially on that topic, looking at workhouses. I always have an interest in how governments treat the poorer, most vulnerable members of society. And when I was doing it, my supervisor said, well, we have to look at the famine. And this was around 1980, it was a long time ago. And at that point, and Miriam's probably too young, Ciarán might be too young, but even though the famine was something that really changed Ireland and changed the rest of the world, it was something that was not taught in schools, in universities, it was not talked about. And at that point, only two books had been written on this major, major topic. So to me, it was pretty daunting. And the orthodoxy at the time was probably the famine was inevitable, the British government did all they could, and Ireland didn't change that much. So that was the orthodoxy that I came to this great topic with. And as I began researching, I came to reject that orthodoxy, and I came to believe that the famine was not inevitable, the British government could and should have done more, and that Ireland's changed in major, significant ways that still impact today. So that was sort of my starting point, and at the time I was very much out of step with the mostly male historical establishment in Ireland. Now I'm pretty orthodox. So there's been a massive sea change, which is heartening. But, you know, it's taken, as Ciarán said, a generation. So I've written on the famine, and I've continued to engage that topic. And as Miriam said, I moved to America, I think 2007, and in 2013 I was invited to Quinnipiac to be director of Alan's Greyhound Institute, which was great, so here I am. But around that time, maybe earlier, I was asked to write a book on Daniel O'Connell. And if you don't know Daniel O'Connell, to Irish people, he's our liberator. He was born a Catholic in Kerry in 1775. Because he was Catholic, like other Catholics, he was disadvantaged in many, many areas. So he couldn't get an education in Ireland. He was educated in France. He came back. Legislation changed. He was able to become a lawyer if he'd been born a few years earlier. He couldn't have been. And he became the most brilliant lawyers. And he used his knowledge of the law, of the Constitution, to continually challenge the British government. The main area in which he challenged them was Catholics could not be members of the British Parliament. Even though Ireland, a colony of Britain, had been governed from London since 1800, Catholics, the majority of Irish people, had no representation. And he masterminded a brilliant campaign that was peaceful. And that was one of the things he believed you should use law, constitutional means, to put pressure on the government. This really was unheard of, but he mobilised people. This is the 1820s, and people who themselves were poor, often illiterate, maybe Irish-speaking, yet he just had such charisma and such a vision, and knew how to use the press, etc. So he mobilised this mass movement in Ireland, and as a result of it, the British government actually backed down. So in 1829, the British government granted what is known as Catholic emancipation. So after this date, Catholics from anywhere in the United Kingdom could sit in the British Parliament. And of course, Daniel O'Connell was a member of the British Parliament from 1829 until his death in 1847. So he really became a champion of the Irish people. They called him the Liberator. Apparently, when news reached America that this had happened, the Liberty Bell was rung in Philadelphia. So clearly he was a transatlantic figure. So, you know, a great man, a very powerful man, many, many skills. But, you know, I thought came to him with some scepticism. He was very much empire building. He very much promoted his family. He at times went into coalition with the British government, which sometimes disappointed the Irish people. So I wasn't a total fan of O'Connell when I was asked to write this book about him. But, you know, I still recognised his strengths. So I came and I started to research on him, and I was looking at his speeches and some of his lesser known speeches, and I came to realise that not only was he a champion in Ireland, Daniel O'Connell was maybe one of the first, or a very early, human rights champion the world over. So as soon as he achieved Catholic emancipation, he started to advocate for Jewish emancipation. He agitated for the rights of the Maoris in New Zealand, for the rights of Aborigines in Australia, for the rights of natives in what we call British India, and he campaigned and did so very effectively for the end of slavery. Yeah. And he really became, most people know the name of William Wilberforce, but in many ways O'Connell surpassed Wilberforce as this giant transatlantic figure who wanted to bring about the end of enslavement. And so I started to really admire him, not so much as the liberator of the Catholic emancipation, but as this human rights figure. And, of course, by studying O'Connell, he led me to Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass, even before he came to Ireland, he heard of O'Connell and greatly admired him. And he said he stayed in Ireland partly in the hope of meeting him, which he did. So I have this interest now in Irish abolition, which hasn't really been written about, that I could see was this very vibrant movement, very important movement. And all my friends in Ireland, Don Mullen, who is sometimes associated with Bloody Sunday, he was present Bloody Sunday in Derry, who also has an interest in Frederick Douglass, said, well, you know, nobody knows his speeches. Why don't you just try and track them down and maybe transcribe them? So I said, oh, that would be interesting. So I started thinking, yeah, just something to keep me in the news. What I didn't realise was when Frederick was in Ireland, he made over 50 speeches. He didn't write them down, and some of them lasted over 2 hours. But mostly they were covered by newspapers. And so I systematically, my daughter would say obsessively, started to search for Frederick in the newspapers. And it took me about 8 years to, I think, complete and find all his speeches. There might be some I didn't find. And I always said it sort of became a labour of love. And I had some very powerful family illness, and Frederick almost became, during that time, my solace. So I felt very close to Frederick. Anyway, so I transcribed speeches, and that came out, it was two volumes, it was so big. So that came out for Frederick's birthday in 2018, and as you say, it's two volumes. But then, having done my research on Frederick, I started to understand the network within which he worked, partly in America, mostly in Ireland, and started to realize he was the most famous, he's the most remembered black abolitionist to visit Ireland, but he wasn't the only one. And so that started me on the next phase of my search.
Christine, when you, in the opening of the book, you assert that Frederick asserted or observed that Irish abolitionists were the most ardent he had ever encountered. Some people might be slightly surprised to hear that. Can you tell us the context in which Douglas would have made that assertion?
Yeah, so Frederick, again, you probably know his story, the American, better than I do. But as you know, he was born into enslavement. He somehow became self-educated, we know how. And he knew that he couldn't be a slave, he just knew. And so he attempted to escape a few times. He finally escaped in 1838. He came to New York, he married Anna Murray, and he settled in New Bedford. He could have gone to Canada where he would have been safe, but he said, no, I need to fight for other people to liberate themselves. So he was very interested in abolition. He started to read The Liberator. He attended an anti-slavery meeting in Nantucket. And he was unusual. He was a former enslaved person, and he was called on to speak. And he said his knees were shaking, but he got up. And, of course, he was very articulate, and he had this compelling life story. And somebody in the audience was William Lloyd Garrison, who was mesmerized, as were the whole of the audience, and called upon the audience to say, is this a man or is this a thing we see before us? And, of course, you know, a man. So Garrison very cannily employed Frederick to be an agent for the American Anti-Slavery Society. So Frederick did that. And even though he was self-taught, he's clearly brilliant. If you read his speeches, he has so many cultural, biblical, historical reference points. And they're just, again, mesmerizing. So he told his story, but he was very careful because there was a Fugitive Slave Act, the one that preceded the 1850 Act, which meant at any time he could be captured and returned into enslavement. And so he was very cautious about giving information. And so people started to say, as a way of propaganda, really, that he wasn't really a slave. He was a fix, he was a plant, whatever. So in 1845, he decided to publish his narrative. It wasn't the first narrative, but it's the most well-known narrative. And it was a major success. And again, if you haven't read it, I would urge you to please go and read it. But this narrative propelled him to some stage of abolition, and it really meant he was in even more danger of being recaptured. So at this point, his friends, including Garrison, persuaded him he needed to go to the United Kingdom because there he would be safe. Garrison wasn't being totally altruistic because he wanted to build a transatlantic slavery movement. And he knew that Frederick Douglass was such a powerful weapon in giving this message. So Frederick came. He landed in Liverpool. That was the major route. He stayed in Liverpool for 2 days, and then he sailed to Dublin. And he went to Dublin because some abolitionists in Dublin, headed by Richard Webb, a Quaker printer, had said, I will print an Irish version copy of your narrative so that when you are here, you can sell it and you will have money to live on. So Frederick came to Dublin expecting to stay 4 days just to arrange with Richard Webb the reprint of his narrative. And he was so warmly welcomed, he stayed for 4 months. And at that point, very early on, the first day he was there, he wrote to Garrison saying, I'm not safe in Ireland, safe in old Ireland. But within 2 weeks, he was writing to Garrison talking about the ardency of the Irish abolitionists, and even at that stage saying, at that time, for the first time in his life, not only did he feel safe, he felt he was equal. And that was a feeling he'd never experienced again, and when he left Ireland, he never experienced it. So for him, that was, and he uses the word, it's not my, and it's very important to use his word, he described being in Ireland as a transformative experience.
So fascinating stuff, Christine. We kind of decided today we would elevate the story of the female abolitionist in your collection, Sarah Parker-Remond. I want to give a shout out to actually one of the alumna of our program, Maureen Dunphy-Brady, is actually working on a book on Sarah at the moment. But Christine, for you, can you tell us about Sarah and tell us what the dual combination of her being black and female in this context would have meant in terms of her time in Ireland, obviously, specifically, or in Europe more generally?
So, if I can just say that Sarah also has a brother, Charles Lennox Remond. He's a great friend of Frederick Douglass. And when Frederick first onto the lecture circuit in America, he and Charles would lecture together. And one of Frederick's sons was actually named Charles Lennox Douglass. So it's very close, and it's probable that Sarah knew Frederick from when she was young. She was, I think, 16 years younger than her brother Charles. Charles also came to Ireland, and he's an incredibly interesting person. I hope you can't hear his gardeners, you might. He's sometimes called the Lost Prince of Abolition, and I think he deserves to be better known because he was trailblazing. So Sarah and Charles and their brothers and sisters were actually free. They weren't born enslaved. So they had a very different story to tell. But mostly their focus was on prejudice. They always argued, it's not enough to end slavery. We have to tackle prejudice, and we have to fight for equality. So, and as to Frederick Douglass, the two of them were ideologically very close, as they were, you know, in terms of friendship. So abolition was always very close to other movements. One of them was the women's movement. And in 1840, the American abolition movement split on mainly the women's question, not solely that, but on that, because people like Garrison believed that women were equal to men. And as you know, women were the backbone of abolition. They're just not always recognized, and you know, often their names are, as we know, hidden in history. Frederick, when he came back from Ireland, one of the first things he did was he went to Seneca Falls, and he signed the Declaration of Sentiments for women's suffrage. So there was this big unity, or large unity, between the two movements. Sarah came to Ireland in 1859, and she was very much, she's so interesting, because Garrison, even though she was admired Garrison and worked with Garrison, Garrison tried to present her as his protege who's coming to Ireland, Britain. And she wrote a letter to the press before she arrived, saying, you know, I'm coming here as an individual because, you know, I want to see what I can do. So very much aware of her own power. But as you say, she really did face that double prejudice, you know, both her gender and her race. But she used both to her advantage. And one of the things Sarah did, and one of her contributions, which the men couldn't do, and sometimes they shied away from talking about the unpalatable aspects of enslavement for women. She actually directed many of her lectures about how awful it was to be a female slave. And she talked about issues of rape, of the way women were treated, of them being separated from their children, etc. And she appealed to women abolitionists in Ireland and Britain. And in that sense, she spoke very, very directly. And again, it's very much in contrast with men who tended to see it through a much more masculine prism. So she really added a different dimension to the topic.
I noticed, Christine, that when I go down the list of the 10 profiles that you cover in Black Abolitionists in Ireland, many of them you note are like mixed race, and some of them have like quote unquote Irish surnames. I'm wondering in your research, it's a very, you know, it's a complex issue, something that we've taken on in different ways actually with our previous programs with Lenwood Sloan and Deidre Humphrey Parker, who I believe are, they're both on the line with us today. But on the basis of the research in your, with your sources, Christine, how much, you know, if there was an Irish genetic or cultural connection in the United States, they go to Ireland, did that play out in any meaningful way in terms of identity conflicts or anything?
It's hard to know, but if you say, and I would think Frederick Douglass, at important junctures in his life, there seems to be an Irish presence. and you know, he writes about it. But his mother was Harriet Bailey, and when I think of Bailey, I think it's an Irish name. But you know, Frederick Douglass, and maybe this answers your point, he used to say, he didn't even know his date of birth, his year of birth, and he used to joke because he just had this really lovely sense of humour and self-deprecation, but he'd say, you know, genealogy was not big on the plantations. So you know, how do you know anything? If you don't even know your date of birth, you just approximate the season. I think I was born in spring. So having that real knowledge, I think, would be very, very difficult. Maybe the person you're thinking of, Edmund Kelly, and what we do know about him, his father was an Irishman, and he had a relationship with an enslaved black woman, and they had children, and he actually wanted to buy the freedom of his partner and the children, but that wasn't allowed. So Edmund Kelly grew up, he sometimes calls himself Edward, sometimes Edmund, so he's a bit shadowy, but he grew up enslaved because of that. But he knew he had Irish ancestry, and when he came to Ireland, it was referred to. But it's something, he was one of the, he was quite evangelical, and when he came to Ireland, he wasn't comfortable with Catholics. So, again, the dynamics are always very different. But newspapers referred to, oh, yeah, he's Kelly, his father was Irish. But he himself didn't really refer to that in terms of his identity. So it does vary.
For the benefit, actually, for people not that familiar, and actually for us all, for a refresher, Christine, I think that context is important in terms of the evangelical influence on abolitionism and how in a Catholic Ireland, wherein Catholicism is a marker of identity in terms of, you know, the masses and the people on the lower rungs of the ladder, and how that kind of would have led to some kind of cleavages, perhaps, in terms of, you know, there wasn't a seamlessness there, I guess, on religious grounds.
Yeah, and, you know, as I say, it's complicated. It really, really is complicated. So British abolition, you know, we talked about Wilberforce, late 18th century, very much associated with evangelicals. The men who founded it were called the 12 Apostles, the men Wilberforce and those around him. And one of their beliefs was it was awful that these enslaved people are denied access to the Bible, that part of our mission is not just to free them, but we need to Christianize them. So that was part of their mission. And some of this attitude was adopted by some of the abolitionists I write about. So I think three of them, Ringwald, Ward, who you just mentioned, and Henry Highland, they were all ministers, sorry, Kelly. And they very consciously lectured in Protestant locations, which is very different. So when Daniel O'Connell was first on the scene, Daniel O'Connell became involved in abolition 1823. And even though he was involved in other campaigns for Catholic emancipation, for repeal of the Union, he rarely, if ever, made a public speech in which he did not refer to the blot of slavery. So it was always on his consciousness. And from the very outset, he was at the radical end of abolition. He believed it should be total and immediate. He also argued, and this was controversial, that black people were equal to white people. And again, not everybody thought that. So from the very early days, he positioned himself at the radical end. But he brought a Catholic voice to the movement, which again provided a balance and a nuance, I suppose, a nuance. Most of the abolitionists and the early abolitionists in Ireland were Quakers. So the Quaker population in Ireland, at the time of famine, 1845, it was about 3,000 people, so they weren't large in numbers, but they were very effective, and very effective in a number of progressive movements. So slavery, abolition was just one of them. They were for animal rights, they were pacifists, they were mostly for temperance, but the idea of temperance was you could have a glass of wine every now and again, so it wasn't teetotalism. Was very different, but they were very progressive then for prison reform, etc. So when Frederick came to Ireland, he stayed with the Webbs, who were Quaker families. This was the same families who during the famine went to the west of Ireland to give relief to the starving Irish. And when Charles, Raymond and Sarah came to Ireland, they also stayed with the Webb family. So, and a lot of the networks where they lectured, they were provided by the Quakers. So it was a very interesting dynamic. But a few of the people who came who did not stay with the Webbs, the people I've mentioned, they were already ministers and they tended to take a more evangelical view. The other division, which is not religious, but just to add to the complexity, in 1840, as I said, the anti-slavery movement had split in America. Garrison was the American anti-slavery movement, again, radical. The more moderate wing of the new movement was the American and foreign anti-slavery movement, much more conservative, much more gradual, etc., against women being equal, etc., etc. The Quakers in Dublin and the south of Ireland allied with Garrison. The abolitionists in the south and in Dublin allied with Garrison. The abolitionists based in Belfast were more moderate and allied with the American and foreign, or the American and British anti-slavery society. So when Frederick Douglass and Sarah came, they had to navigate these divides, these existing fault lines. And I think it's such a tribute that particularly, and to me, Charles, Sarah, Frederick, they really stand out because they were able to negotiate all these divisions of religion, of social class, social justice within Ireland, and still to work both sides. Garrison at one point was terrified that Frederick was going to the other side, and he actually came to Britain to join Frederick to make sure he kept in line and didn't leave his society. So it just, the dynamics are interesting, but they're just incredibly complex.
You touched on O'Connell there, Christine, and I guess one question that I feel is worth asking is how, I think O'Connell in particular is at the interface to some extent in that, you know, what we kind of started off with it in terms of you framing Douglass seeing Ireland as, and you use the word in the book, I read the introduction, you use that word, and I don't know if they use that word, Ireland as a sanctuary, Ireland as a place where they see our Frederick, at least maybe the others felt like they were treated as equals in a way that they hadn't here. But when there was a difference between the Irish in Ireland and Irish America in that regard, and I believe that it's Dan and O'Connell at some point is really at the interface in that regard. Can you contextualize that a little bit on the basis of your research?
That makes me think sometimes, so I use the word sanctuary, but people like Frederick would use safety, I'm here and I feel safe, so a few of them said that. But I think, and it's particularly evident with Frederick, but a lesser extent with some of the other abolitionists, is Ireland forced them to rethink what privilege and white privilege meant. And eventually the case of Frederick, he stayed with Quakers. And even though the people he stayed with were middle-class, prosperous, successful businessmen, because they were Quakers, they were disadvantaged in the way Catholics had been. Quakers, as Catholics before them, could not be members of the British Parliament. And they'd been subject, like Catholics, to certain religious limitations. So even though these people ostensibly seemed to be successful and they were white, Frederick could see that they were not equal within society. The other thing that really shocked Frederick and William Wells Brown and Sarah spoke about it was the utter poverty of Ireland. And again, they all wrote about this, saying that William Wells Brown says he comes to Dublin expecting to see these beautiful houses and buildings, and he spends a day going, as Frederick did, going into the really poor areas of Dublin. And they were shocked because they did not believe such poverty could exist in Europe or in Ireland or in something that was at the heart of the British Empire. And Frederick writes, he's only witnessed that level of poverty on the plantations. And so for him, it's really shocking. And it really, you can see within 4 months, he's really reformulating what is privilege, what is oppression. And when he leaves Dublin, he leaves Belfast, goes to Scotland, and after 2 weeks in Scotland, he writes to Garrison, says, now I'm outside it, I really have reflected on my time in Ireland. And he talks about, the poverty he's seeing and how it's made him refine his view of what it means to be oppressed. And he says, and there's a very famous quote, which I don't want to screw up, but he talks about, I came to Ireland with just one mission. I was an abolitionist. But now I see the cause of humanity is the same the world over. And unless I fight against injustice everywhere, I'm not a real abolitionist. And it's just so powerful that he recognises that transformation within him.
And then when he comes back, is he finding that warmth and solidarity and support in the Irish American community that he interfaces with?
So Irish America is tricky and it's not good. Irish America, and for many complex reasons, does not really embrace abolition. Daniel O'Connell, it drives him crazy because in America he has all this support for repeal, but some of the people who are supporting him for repeal of the Act of Union for Irish independence also think to him, you know, don't get caught up in this slavery question. It's too complex, you're over there, you know nothing about it. You just stick to repeal of the Union. And in 1843, just as Daniel O'Connell is about to be imprisoned for having a meeting for repeal, he writes what to me is one of the most magnificent statements in defense of abolition, the Cincinnati Letter, if any of you haven't read it, I would say read it. And in it, he chastises Irish Americans. He says, you're not Irish. You are not. This is not the loving atmosphere you were brought up in. And unless you embrace abolition and reject slavery, you are no longer Irish. So he does that over 11 pages. So it perplexes him. You know, why does this happen? And so Frederick comes to Ireland and he sees the ardency of Irish abolition. And then he returns to America and he's confronted with prejudice. And he sees that Irish Americans are not supporting the cause. And he's sort of angry. And he goes from anger to being perplexed to anger. And he writes about it. And he writes pretty, without restraint, criticizing Irish Americans for their stance, which, again, I want to say is complicated, but yeah, essentially he's very frustrated by them. But by the 70s, 80s, he's still frustrated by Irish Americans, the fact they've never really embraced abolition, the fact that many of them seem to be racist. But by the 1880s, Frederick has come to support Irish Home Rule. And at one point he writes, well, you know, Irish Americans haven't supported me in their quest, you know, in our quest for freedom. But that doesn't mean I will not support them in their quest for independence. So, again, Frederick just, I think he just shines a light of, you know, tolerance, you know, understanding things, yes, accepting, still trying to change, and just the tolerance and kindness that I just think permeates everything he does. So, but yeah, he's very angry. So O'Connell's angry with Irish Americans. Marianne McCracken, who you might know, she is Sister Henry Joan McCracken, an Irish Republican who was hanged in 1798 for his role in trying to win independence. And she was an ardent abolitionist. And she met Frederick Douglass when he was in Belfast, 1845, 1846. This really worried her. So she would go to the port sides in Belfast and she had leaflets to hand out to people leaving the island saying, remember when you leave the country, do not support slavery. So she thought she knew something that was happening on this Atlantic journey. So it was something that people in Ireland were really aware of and it really worried them that this was happening.
Can I ask you, Christine, on the basis of the research for these individuals and, of course, your commitment to recounting Frederick Douglass's trip to Ireland, do you get a sense in those sources as to how individually or as a collective these people were greeted or interacted with by, I'm trying to get a sense of the texture of ordinary Irish, many of them would have been living in really abject poverty and really dire conditions at the time, even outside the period of the famine, the big famine itself. But do the sources allow you to get a sense of that?
So as I said, Frederick's papers were destroyed, his house in Rochester was burnt down, so a lot of his papers haven't existed, so I'm certainly not for that very early period. And most of the people who gave speeches, they didn't write them down. So what I had to do, and it's imperfect in one way, is I trawled the newspapers, the British newspapers, the Irish newspapers, some of the American newspapers, to see if I could get a sense of where they lectured, when they lectured, what they said. So it comes through that medium. And again, newspapers then and now were pretty partisan. So Protestant newspapers would not mention when Frederick praised O'Connell. They'd leave that behind, whereas, of course, the nationalist newspapers would flag it up. So I tried to use all shades of opinion to get the fuller picture. But one of the great things about the newspapers is they would describe the audience, they would describe how much it cost. So most of the lectures were free. and they would put in, and this I listened to him when I did my transcription, cheers, applause, loud applause, spontaneous applause. So from the newspaper account, you really get a sense of how the audience interacted. And in the case of Frederick, how much they loved him. And I think, and Sarah as well, she was, I mean, these people are incredible speakers, but a few times, Frederick, in his very musical, at the end of the lecture, he would sing. And it's almost like he felt liberated, comfortable enough that he could express himself in that way. So although the newspapers have some limitations, in that sense, they really do give us an insight into the composition of the audience and how they reacted with Frederick. And his speeches, they actually, his speeches, they outline them.
I'm going to ask you one more question, Christine, before I open it up and remind people viewing that if you'd like to email any questions into ireland.house@nyu.edu, Amber will send that along to me. I'd like us to make a note of the fact that you're profiling these 10 abolitionists, but I think you guesstimate or approximately 80 travelled to Britain in that time, and you I think you hypothesise probably more, that there are maybe like many more than that obviously made that trip. And I'm just wondering, Christine, you know, I know we're always kind of, we're a victim of our sources, and that might be why you chose these people, but is there anything that marks these individuals spanning the time period that they do out in terms of why they go to Ireland specifically? You know, they're going to Great Britain, and Ireland is part of that political union, but is there anything that brings them specifically to Ireland, or is it more haphazard and ad hoc in that sense?
I think it's very deliberate, and it's actually Claire Richards who's written, and he estimated 80 black abolitionists came to Britain, and he says maybe 6 of them came to Ireland, so clearly the number is a lot larger. A few of them I knew their stories about before, and there was more written about them. Some of them came to me as I was looking. I'd never heard of Edmund Kelly before. He's just a shadowy figure. Benjamin Benson is a really shadowy figure. Definitely never heard of him. But the sources led me to people. And then you have to stop somewhere, so I stopped at 10. But I have found a few more I'd like to write about. So we'll see. I thought I might be doing it by now, but I'm not. But there aren't great sources, and that's why newspapers became, in many ways, invaluable. But what really struck me about these 10 people, and just one of them, Sarah's my only woman, that I've come across another woman who also went to Ireland, is they're all very individual. So even though there might be something in common, really, their stories, the way they present themselves, it's different. And that was fascinating.
And now, following my chat with Christine Keneally, Professor Christine Keneally of Quinnipiac University, we're going to hear from Ian Gray delivering words from a speech, an 1865 speech by Frederick Douglass. Enjoy, folks.
Let's hear from Frederick Douglass in his own words. Now, this is a speech from 1865, and he's speaking to the Massachusetts Slavery Society. I noticed, Christine, that role of the individual societies, there's a topography of organizations which are playing a massive role in all of this.
Yeah, I think 2000 by the 40s.
The story of our inferiority is an old dodge. As I have said, for whoever men oppress their fellows, wherever they enslave them, they will endeavor to find a needed apology for such enslavement and oppression in the character of the people oppressed and enslaved. When we wanted, a few years ago, a slice of Mexico, it was hinted that the Mexicans were an inferior race, that the old Castilian blood had become so weak that it would scarcely run downhill, and that Mexico needed the long and strong and beneficent arm of the Anglo-Saxon care extended over it. We said that it was necessary to its salvation and a part of the manifest destiny of this republic to extend our arm over the dilapidated government. So too, when Russia wanted to take possession of a part of the Ottoman Empire, the Turks were an inferior race. So too, when England wants to set the heels of her power more firmly in the quivering heart of old Ireland, the Celtics are an inferior race. So too, the Negro, when he is to be robbed of any right which is justly his, is an inferior man. It is said that we are ignorant, I admit. But if we know enough to be hung, we know enough to vote. If the Negro knows enough to pay taxes to support the government, he knows enough to vote. Taxation and representation should go together. If he knows to shoulder a musket to fight for the flag, fight for the government, he knows enough to vote. If he knows as much when he is sober as an Irishman knows when drunk, he knows enough to vote on good American principles. Do you intend to sacrifice the very men who have come to rescue of your banner in the South and incur the lasting displeasure of their masters thereby? Do you intend to sacrifice them and reward your enemies? Do you mean to give your enemies the right to vote and take it away from your friends? Is that wise policy? Is that honorable? I mean, could American honor withstand such a blow? I do not believe you will do it. I think you will see to it that we have the right to vote. We look naturally to this platform for the assertion of all rights, and for this one especially. I understand the anti-slavery societies of this country to be based on two principles. First, the freedom of the blacks of this country, and second, the elevation of them. Let me not be misunderstood here. I'm not asking for sympathy at the hands of the abolitionists, sympathy at the hands of any. I think the American people are disposed often to be generous rather than just. What I ask for the Negro is not benevolence, not pity, not sympathy, but simply justice. The American people have always been anxious to know, what shall they do? Everybody has asked the question, and can learn to ask it early of the abolitionists. What shall we do with the Negro? I've had but one answer from the beginning. Do nothing with us. Your doing with us has already played the mischief with us. Do nothing with us. If the apples will not remain on the tree of their own strength, if they are worm-eaten at the core, if they are early ripe and disposed to fall, let them fall. I'm not for the tying or fastening them on the tree in any way except by nature's plan. And they will not stay there, let them fall. If the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let them fall also. All I ask, give him a chance to stand on his own legs. Let him alone. If you see him on his way to school, let him alone. Don't disturb him. If you see him going to the dinner table at the hotel, let him go. If you see him going to the ballot box, let him alone. Don't disturb him. If you see him going into a workshop, just let him alone. Your interference is doing him a positive injury. Let him fall if he cannot stand alone. If the Negro cannot live by the line of internal justice, the fault will not be yours. It will be his who made the Negro and established that line for his government. Let him live or die by that. If you will only untie his hands and give him a chance, I think he will live.
Powerful words. Christine, congratulations on a fine contribution to our understanding of the complexity and the nuances and the solidarity between people who cross the Atlantic. I commend you on your work in this, and thank you for closing out our series for the spring of the Black, Brown and Green Voices series, and I'm grateful to Eoin Gray. The image was lagging, I know, folks, but I think the audio was powerful and worked well. Congrats again, Christine, and thank you for your generosity of time and spirit with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I think this has been a great series, so I am so glad to hear it's continuing. Thank you.
Yeah, and on that, we will resume in the fall on the 8th of October. Professor Kimberly McLean da Costa is going to talk about multiracial identity and the intersection of Irishness and African Americanness. She's Boston Irish African American herself and a fine sociologist. And then in November, on November 5th, we're going to hear from Brian Dooley, Brian's book on the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland and the civil rights movement in the United States has been an important intervention from when it was first published 20 years ago. Thank you to my colleagues David and Amber for their help today, and thank you again for being here. I want to take this moment call on you to use this moment in history to show solidarity to people of colour. The work of these abolitionists should only be the stuff of history books. Only the stuff of history books. We have a proverb in the Irish language which is Ní neart a chur na chéile, which translates is there is no strength without unity. Let's unite, folks. Thank you.
I now have the pleasure of sharing with you a musical interlude by May and Henry. I shared it last week and I'm delighted to do that again, folks. So some musical reflection. Enjoy.
I don't know. if I had money enough to spend, and leisure time to sit a while. There is a friendly in the town who for things has my heart beguiled. Thank you.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour, as well as on irishradio.com. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Sláinte agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.
Well, good morning, friends. You're very welcome. Okay, this is the... Ah, yeah, there you are now. That's my own theme song. Yeah, that's been the theme song, actually, for about 50 years. Actually, more than that. And the reason I'm making a big fuss about it is that I couldn't find it there for a few minutes. I thought somebody maybe... took that record and smashed it or something. Anyway, that's beside the point. Friends, here we are, and we're a week out from summer, but we didn't have to wait for it in the New York area, because in the Tri-State area here, because it feels like summer, and it's a lovely day, and one that, that I hope all of us will make the best of. And today we have as our guest today, we will have our guest. First of all, we have Kieran Madden, who is the Consul General of Ireland, and he'll be joining us a little bit later in the program. And with them we have George Haslam, George actually heads up Origin Theatre, and he will tell us a bit about Bloomsday. Bloomsday coming up on Tuesday, the 16th. It's a big day of celebration and commemoration of a tradition that actually took off more in the United States than just about anywhere else in the world. I want to tell you that today's program and all programming on Irish Radio Network USA, and irishradio.com are produced, which is the executive producer of all the programming around here, Anya Sheridan. And friends, of the times that are in it, I think that for most of our listeners, considering we are simulcasting our program throughout the world on irishradio.com, there's plenty of, I think, perhaps more than any other time in recent history, at least anyway, the focus on America right now is, it's twofold. Number one, we have, of course, the pandemic, the COVID-19, the coronavirus that doesn't seem to be going away. Everybody's talking about what happens with the second wave expected, you know, in later in the year. Many would think we should not bother with worrying about that, considering that it hasn't gone away. But anyway, you probably have heard enough about that, and hopefully the spike, the spread throughout the United States, and for that matter, the world, is, the story is mixed, but hopefully we will get the other side of it. As a matter of fact, never mind the hopefully, we will somehow get the other side of it. Okay. Let's start off with a little bit of music. If you'd like to reach us, irishradio.com. And if you'd like to send an email, I would suggest you do send it to Anya, A-I-N-E, at irishradio.com. John McSally here, the group of Soma, and the tune, The Rambles of City. programming on Irish Radio begins every Saturday morning, comes from New York, and the first hour is, it comes directly from Gloucester Ireland House at NYU, New York University. It is hosted by Dr. Miriam Nyhan Gray, the program, This Irish American Life, also airs on WNYE 91.5 in the Tri-State area. And this week, this morning, Miriam shared Professor Christine Keneally's recent conversation about her new book, Black Abolitionists in Ireland. And it also, Ian Gray read from an 1865 speech by Frederick Douglass. Very interesting program, and I did mention that we will be having Ciarán Madden, the Consul General of Ireland, and the African American Irish Diaspora Network was launched in the Irish Consulate towards the end of February, and this new forum aims to explore the links between Irish and African American identity. So we take it from there with Ciarán Madden. Anyway, meanwhile, Larry Cunningham said to pack his bags and head up to County Tyrone.
Yes. Way up in the north, in old Tyrone, there's big sugar like all my own. Gold and Ireland ever grow. And here is the moon and stars above us. Head over here above, and I'll be here for a moment in the county of Tyrone. There's two little girls that don't go bad, just as pretty as mud. And into every roving eye is known. But against that eye, be out of bounds, there's a deep close note. I'll be in Cavanova, in the county of Tyrone. Now she wears my ring and tells her friend she's gonna marry me. And best of all, she says the most, she's happy as can be. Oh, look at me. Well, I don't know what she's done for me. But nothing else can I tell. I'll be in Cavanova, in the county of Tyrone. Okay, it's you. Was down in the south in old Samoa, I saw that yellow dress. I saw her on the beach all alone. But I guess it was my lucky day when she went there on holiday. A beautiful girl from over in the county of Tyrone. There's two little girls in old Japan, and just as pretty as one. And it's to every roving eye is known. But against that I'd be out of bounds, cause there be people close north of town. My baby, the girl from Oman, in the county of Tyrone. Now she wears my ring and tells her friend she's going to marry me. And best of all, she tells them all, she's happy as can be. Oh, lucky me. Well, I don't know what she's done to me, but there's nothing else that I can do. I'm a beautiful girl from Oman, in the county of Tyrone. My beautiful girl from Oman, in the county of Tyrone. Hi, that's it.
Yeah, that's it there, Larry. Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome indeed. Yes. Okay. We might want to head up to Canada, actually, to a great song, an Irish Canadian song, called the Song of the Myra.
Warm afternoon, old men go fishing, black sand
and spoon. And if they catch nothing, they'll never complain. I wish I knew. as boys in sports cars, girls on the shore. These are the ones that they can dearly adore. Dancing, eating, courting me again. I wish I'm with them again. Can you imagine the peace of the universe?
Kevin O'Connor, who will bring us news and sports as he's done and continues to do, and that should be about, give or take, 45 minutes from now. A lot happening in Ireland as well. Everything from, of course, well, the great excitement is about the loosening of very strict government-enforced restrictions due to the coronavirus. But anyway, that's it. Friends, easiest way to reach us again, Aine, A-I-N-E, at irishradio.com. Of course, as we know, international traveling is not in the cards right now. But in the meantime, Tourism Ireland have produced so many beautiful and fantastic areas of Ireland, which you'll find on ireland.com. The video clips, great stories, many of which, of course, we wouldn't spend that much time on if we were heading for the airport. But ireland.com, each and every day, beautiful and wonderful, warm kind of renditions from Tourism Ireland. Check it out, ireland.com. It is Kenny's and the Gathering.
Brothers and sisters scattered like leaves, friends and lovers carried on the breeze, flying east from Ireland's eyes, sailing west from Shannon's side. But we're no longer refugees, we're proud people and we are free. Throw off the cloak of poverty, hear the air of liberty.
Gathering, and one of the most successful campaigns that was rolled out by Tourism Ireland a few years ago, basically encouraged people to come to Ireland. Prior to that, of course, there would have been Ireland being a preferred destination, the first, the most popular destination, in Europe. It was nothing new for families and for people to travel across to check on, for many. Check on the routes, and of course many others going to Ireland to join family members. But the Irish heading for Ireland, the Irish Americans that went to Ireland, many for the first time, and indeed many who had made the trip so many times. The Gathering was indeed such a tremendous success. It led to, of course, the clan gatherings, and it gave many people throughout the world a chance to plan to be in Ireland. Again, the family gatherings were became extremely popular, and hopefully that will happen soon again. I want to go back to the 50s and the McNulty family, great Irish-American family of musicians, and they did they gave a new birth to an old custom, in that you know, they came up with some original, but mostly took some of the tunes and the songs that had been long forgotten, and it became so much a part of the Irish American entertainment scene. You know, they actually a couple of the family had already you know, served their time in vaudeville during the Roaring Twenties, very much part of the tradition of New York. But they had a very unique presentation of songs that, again, had been forgotten, but many, you know, would look back on their own lives and say it all started with the McNulty family. They were New York based, but they would play so much of a part in Irish American areas like the Rockaways. And anyway, let me give you a taste of the McNulty family, and again, just going back to the early 50s. Hills of Knocking Sheep.
Dear friends, we meet in love tonight on Columbia's frozen shore. 3,000 miles from there, and while we there may see no more. How dear it is, those fairy hills, no other place would be. Like my own dear native motherland, they call it not machine. While deeply pictured in my mind, those hills I've often seen. The space and scenes around Ballymote and the hills around Dalkeen. The lakes and streams around Timble House, their view so far to see. May the heavens above be with you, love, and the hills of Knocknashee.
La 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 country where you have a morn that grows of mountain trees.
The Magnolias there. Friends, I would like to take our microphones now to the Irish Consulate in New York and the Consul General of Ireland, Kieran Madden, who hails actually from Cork. Kieran, you're very welcome to the program.
Thanks, Adrian. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and growing up in Ireland. I won't ask you when, but where, and what are your earliest reflections, you know, of growing up in the Emerald Isle?
God, I suppose the world was a very small place for me. I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Cork City. And looking back on it, it's just how little of the world we knew, how little of the world we even considered knowing. You know, the end of the road was far away. The next parish was almost unthinkable. The next parish was an adventure. So we were very narrow in our experience, really, compared to the kids these days who can just see the whole world with the click of a button, which is obviously far better. And then, of course, the other thing, looking back on it, is how homogenous it all was.
Yeah. When did you choose the career, or did you ease into the foreign service, the government foreign service? Was that a choice of 1, 2, 3, 4 career choices as you were, you know, as you were entering coming out of college in China?
When I was in college, I was studying history, but mainly foreign policy history, and the idea of being in the foreign service sounded terribly exciting and probably fancy in a way, and I kind of set it as a goal. And, you know, a bit then that goes to your marks, you get inside and you're going, oh, is this what's inside? You know, the idea in the head before you do it is always different to reality. Now, reality is fantastic, and reality is a privilege, but it is, yeah, that was something I kind of thought I'd like to do it, and was then surprised when it came through.
Yeah. You know, a week from now is a huge event. There's an election for the UN Security Council, which in fact, I know this is not your particular area, but
yeah.
Tell us about, you know, the significance of Ireland's, you know, placement, and what does it actually mean, particularly in light of, you know, all of the massive changes, some of them, you know, coming overnight, and others that have been a lot. What is the seat on the Security Council, and why is Ireland, you know, made to get it?
Not only are mad to get it, Ireland will get it. So there's an election on Wednesday, the 17th.
Okay.
And it is Ireland, Norway, and Canada running for 2 seats on the UN Security Council, and every UN member has 2 votes. And Ireland launched a campaign for election. We announced that we'd run many years ago. We launched a campaign here in New York on the 2nd of July 2018. So it was the Taoiseach, we have Radcliffe, the Taoiseach, to Simon Coveney, Bono, and of course our ambassador to the United Nations, Geraldine Byrne-Nathan, launched the campaign in the UN Garden just under 2 years ago. And so the 3 themes that are kind of picked out as part of the campaign are empathy, independence, and partnership. And each of these drilled down. So I suppose Ireland at the UN Security Council is such a fundamental chamber where discussions happen that shape the future of the world and deal with issues challenging the global order at any given time. And Ireland would bring an independent voice to that table. It would bring a voice of small nations to that table. And given our own history in terms of the Great Famine or history of colonization.
Yeah.
That's where the empathy comes. So these challenges still exist in some parts of the world. We have been through some of this, and we can share experience on that. And then also Ireland has demonstrated its commitment to addressing these kinds of issues, you know, for decades, through with the longest continuous member of peacekeeping, participant in UN peacekeeping, Ireland is. And then our overseas aid program is consistently ranked as one of the best and most effective in the world. So we put our money where our mouth is, we put our people where our mouth is, and for Ireland to take the seat from 1 January next year, I think would be really, really important. I think we would make an enormous contribution at that table.
I gather from you that you have a feeling that that Ireland is very well positioned for this, and that brings us back actually to that the famous launch in the garden of the United Nations here in New York. It was a great launch itself. And there wasn't a level of confidence then. It was being rolled out, but it was so important that it was worth campaigning for, and it was one hell of a campaign.
It was a hell of a campaign. What I'm saying here is that Ireland should be. I don't want to add any more pressure to colleagues who are working day and night to help win this election. And anyone who ever runs for election in anything, whether it's in school or whether it's for government, yeah, you know, knows you can't count on the votes until they're counted after the fact. I don't want to add pressure. Yeah. But I'm saying Ireland has this remarkably strong case to make, and leaders in Ireland, political leaders and public service, other public service leaders, have gone around the world making that case.
Yes.
So the campaign has been strong, the message is strong, and the message is strong because it is anchored in reality. And the campaign led here in New York by Geraldine Bernaysen has just been phenomenal. It's a huge effort. So should we be successful on Wednesday? I mean, it will go down to people working really, really hard at having a fundamental message, fundamentally positive message to sell about Ireland.
Is the agenda set, or do you get selected, does the country get selected first, and then draft the agenda? Because it's a relatively short period of time. What is it, a year or a couple?
Two years. So 2021 and 2022, full calendar years. It's a combination. So a lot of the agenda items are recurring agenda items. Then obviously the Security Council must react to events in the world as they happen. And then if Ireland was to be successful, I think it's expected that we would end up chairing the council for one or two months over the 2 year period. I think then there's an opportunity to bring some issues forward. But the bulk of it is an existing agenda because it's about reacting to events in the world and reacting to situations in the world. And it's but we actually the best possible way to those.
My guest friend, the Consul General of Ireland and New York here in Madden, I want to do a little flashback to the lead up to St. Patrick's Day, and I suppose when history is recording this year in the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York, the oldest and largest parade anywhere in the world, we will remember as well the huge disappointment that came our way in tandem with the coronavirus and whatever, but on the lead up to St. Patrick's Day, there was a first in the Irish Consulate, led indeed by yourself, where the African American Irish Diaspora Network was actually launched. And perhaps you will, you know, tell us what, if it, when I say it was the first, never did we think that, you know, that the Irish government and indeed the consulate would, you know, highlight or tackle, you know, a topic. If it wasn't taboo, it wasn't, you know, no attention had been paid to, you know, the reality of the great affiliation and association, you know, of the African American history and their Irish association. What was the emphasis that had you single-handedly take that on board?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. The first thing is not single-handedly. The African American Irish Diaspora Network, I mean, is set up by a group of people, some of whom you'd know, Miriam Nyhan, of course,
yeah.
known to your listeners, Dr. Miriam Nyhan, Dr. Linwood Sloan, a choreographer and academic from Pittsburgh, who is African American, Irish American, Dennis Brownlee in Washington, D.C., and a number of others. So they are the board of the African American Irish Diaspora Network. I've had a supporting role and hopefully a catalytic supporting role in that network. And we continue to be supportive, but it belongs to them. You know, a pasty-faced guy from Cork isn't the best person to be representing African America or diaspora. But if I can wind it back a bit further, I arrived here just under 3 years ago. And in the first year, or 18 months, I was really knocked over by how almost every event I attended or hosted or spoke at was almost exclusively white audiences. And, you know, in some ways it seemed understandable to me, the Irish America, etc. But it just seemed very odd that in New York City, in the United States, those were the audiences. So I started digging around a little bit and found that many others had done work in this area. And so two numbers are important. There are various estimates about how many members of the African American community have Irish heritage. You're dating between 30% and 38% or less. And some of that, of course, we know goes back to difficult dark history and bad episodes, but a lot of it doesn't. It was just normal human interactions along the way. And then the other number that's important is that one in six people in Ireland were not born on the island of Ireland. So we're a changed country as well. So the audiences I was seeing here were not even representative of Ireland, the Ireland I had left to come here.
Yeah.
So those are the two impetuses. And then you can see that, you know, 30%+ of African Americans have Irish heritage. Why are we not seeing them at our events? And you dig down and, you know, there's an awful lot of history there, some good and some bad. And our goal, I suppose, really is to at least make sure that anyone who feels they have Irish heritage feels welcome at our events. Anyone who doesn't have Irish heritage is welcome also, but that anyone with any Irish heritage should feel welcome at our events. And then with that, we have to explore the history in a serious fashion. You know, we can't just go pick up the positive bits of the Irish-American, African-American intersections, the Irish-African-American intersections. We have also look at the dark bits, you know, were the Irish people involved in slavery? Of course they were. And let's drill down and own our history for good and for bad. And that way we can set a platform to move forward together in a positive way. And the launch itself was just a wonderful event here in the consulate residence.
Yeah.
It was really positive. It was fantastic. The people there, most of the people in the room were African American with Irish heritage, African American, Irish Americans. But the range of people, there were bankers, there were academics, there were musicians, there were actors, there were public servants. It was a real slice through society that also happened to have these other two African American and Irish American kind of qualifiers. And there was a sense of excitement and positivity. And in one way, we're absolutely delighted that the launch happened before the COVID lockdown happened. Of course, the other downside of it is that the launch happened and then the world hit pause for a period. So Even this week I was talking to Dennis Brownlee, who's the chairman of the network, and looking ahead to the autumn and what might be possible to do then, and let's keep the momentum going in this. And this work of breaking down barriers is going to, it will be a long work. I'll be here for a few years, and I'll be gone, and other people will move through. It's a work of years, part of a work of decades, but it's really, really important work to undertake. You know, we wouldn't be having this conversation if there weren't problems of racism. So let's try to take a lead, right, at least within our own communities, make sure that we can show a lead in trying to eliminate that.
Tell us a little bit about this Dennis Brownlee and how he became that interested, as in fact he did, in his Irish heritage. How did he look at that and say, okay, I want to look into this? Was his a casual of casual interest in his Irishness? Was it something that he was that bothered him, that was that something that he felt that he undertook? Where was his motivation, and how did he get into it?
God, I'd hate to speak to anyone else's motivation, and I mean, Dennis told me his own history, but I'm afraid of actually, you know, recounting it incorrectly and giving a bad representation. I'm sure he'd be happy to come and talk on the show at some point also. But what, yeah, I would say, at least from where we are now, is that his isn't a casual interest. You know, he's very passionate about trying to explore these links. He really wants to bring the links alive. So, for example, right now he's looking towards September, October of this year represents the 150th anniversary of Frederick Douglass's visit to Ireland. And obviously it's a much written about, a much celebrated visit. And he sees that as an opportunity, Dennis, and the wider board of the network see that as an opportunity to, again, catalyse more support around these efforts and get more interest, build more excitement. I know he would like to kind of bring people to Ireland, to places that Frederick Douglass visited, but that might be possible in the COVID context, but at least, you know, build up the energy behind all of this. But no, his dedication is certainly, I can't say exactly how it started, apart from the fact that he knows about his Irishness for a long time, but his interest now is far from casual. He's very, very passionate and purposeful with it.
Yeah, and of course the coverage and the contribution of Dr. Miriam Nyhan Gray through, for our audience, through the program, which is extremely very popular, and we present it here on Irish Radio.
Dr. Nyhan Gray has done fantastic work on this for a long time, and one of the things she's doing right now is Black, Brown and Green, which is a collection of oral histories of non-white Irish Americans. And the stories that are coming out in that are just fantastic. They really are. One person telling a story of how the lighter-skinned cousins effectively had an American wake in their home city because they were leaving to go to the white side of the city.
Yeah.
Because they weren't going to see them anymore. These stories, and that was the 1960s. And these stories are heartbreaking. But the reaction to Dr. Megan Gray's oral history, both from those who've been interviewed and those who hear the interviews, is just phenomenal. She really did. And again, I think she knows, we all know, the tip of the iceberg. But she's the one who said, let's start the ship and keep on going down and find more. And she does phenomenal work on it.
We also, and first of all, the oral archive at Glucksman Ireland House are a treasure beyond description. They will forever and a day, be so significant in Irish history, and indeed as the Centre for Irish Studies, the most popular in the United States. This is very much a part of the undertaking of of creating that oral history, and particularly in the environment that we are living in, you know, the African Irish American connection is just something that, indeed, I know that Dr. Miriam, has brought it a long way. And as we say, it wasn't a once off. This is something that was very much in the works, and you know, on the lead up again to St. Patrick's Day. I wanted to also perhaps mention a couple of other people, like Mick Maloney, a musicologist from Limerick, who has, you know, as we look back, Mick Maloney actually took another segment of our history through music. And that was so revealing in terms of, you know, the Irish influence, the Irish connection, and indeed the African-American history through music, through song, through dance. This was something also that was, you know, very strange and foreign to all of us, who on many occasions feel quite comfortable, you know, in living in our own world without any sense of, you know, the level of knowledge or not that we have with respect to aspects of our history, including, of course, the African, the African-American, very tangible history that is there.
Well, yeah, they say Mick Maloney has done fantastic work on it, and his, often when he presents on it, his partner in presentation is Lenwood Sloan, the choreographer, who brings demonstrates the same connections on in dance and music. And Mick Maloney was the first person to tell me about the history of, you know, the history of the banjo coming as a West African instrument to the United States, and then being imported from the United States to Ireland, where it became an integral part of traditional music there. So these connections are there. And the more you dig, even scratching the surface, you come across more and more connections. I mean, I have here in front of me on the desk an academic paper on Irish and African-American interracial marriage in New York City's 8th Ward in 1870. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a pretty narrow slice of life, but it shows the connections were there, the connections are deep, the connections are long-standing. And then you come across some surprising ones, like Marcus Garvey in Madison Square Garden in 1920, August 1920, in the middle of Ireland's War of Independence, reading out his telegram to Eamon de Valera, keep up the fight for a free Ireland. So there are all these unusual connections along the way, the more you dig. But I'd say we have to, you know, there's lots of really positive connections, but we have to own the bad with the good as we explore it, because that's the only way you can move forward.
Yeah, it's a huge undertaking, and it is one that, as I say, this was not a reaction to the coronavirus and then the horrific murder of George Floyd that indeed woke up the world to how insane things were that a lot of us figured, well, you know, that stuff happens anyway. It is something, but I'd like to ask you about a figure I wouldn't have thought of, very few of us, is that 1 in 6 residents of Ireland, citizens of Ireland, are not from Ireland. And how did that play into the economics of Ireland through a period came rapidly, but tell us a little bit about that what contributed to that.
Well, so that goes back to what you were saying at the very start, when you're asking me about my youth. You know, Ireland was a very homogenous place when I was growing up, and you know, in Cork, and I'm sure when you were growing up in Mayo, the same applied there. And I suppose since the 1990s, there's been a lot of inward migration into Ireland, and it's a huge change. It's a change for the better. You know, diversity is always good, but we also have to learn how to deal with it. We have to make sure that we learn from places that have dealt with this before. And you know, the last few weeks, again, in the context of the murder of George Floyd, racism is being explored everywhere, and you see more and more reports of racist incidents in Ireland. So we have to learn how to deal with that and eradicate that, and we have to learn from places that are further along this curve than we are. But overall, it is just a wonderfully positive contribution to Ireland that it is becoming so much more diverse than it was. It'll challenge our thinking, challenge our way of looking at the world, and build up our connections with the world. Now, at the same time, when I say 1 in 6, a huge portion of that 1 in 6 who weren't born on the island will be from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But then there were people from Asia, from Africa, from the United States, and so it's not. The number isn't, the demographic breakdown isn't the same as it is here. But it's all challenging. It means that there's new food in Ireland, there's new music in Ireland, there's shops, yeah. There are shops where other languages other than English and Irish are spoken. And that it adds to the richness of the country and makes us, it better integrates us in the world by bringing the world into Ireland, I suppose.
Yeah, many would, you know, say that the reason or the primary reason that Ireland, you know, welcomed, you know, so many people who came from different countries, they were welcomed more because they were needed. Ireland was, booming with the Celtic Tiger, and a lot of Irish people no longer settled for menial work, work that doesn't pay well. So yeah, sure, come on over. We you're very welcome, and maybe with the help of God, you go home when things get better here. I'm being facetious, but by the same token, isn't there some degree of truth to that? It wasn't that Ireland, held up a sign saying, come one, come all. It was born out of a need, and that tolerance was very closely associated with the economy of Ireland.
Look, absolutely. The reality is that Ireland's economy transformed from the early 90s onwards, and it became, but the economic argument is a two-way one. It's not just that the economy needed more workers, it's also that those workers wanted those jobs. You know, there is people came to Ireland because there was work there. People came to Ireland because there was good quality of life there. So it's a two-way push. There are push and pull factors in that. That's one part of it. The other, of course, is that being part of the single market. And this is, a different argument again. Ireland is part of one giant labour market, which is the European Union. Workers are free to move from one country to another to take up employment. And that means that, US companies, for example, investing in Ireland, they can attract talent from anywhere in Europe without any immigration issues, without any visa issues. It's just people can move straight to work, and that means that specific skills and language skills and other technical skills can be attractive to a job in Dublin or Galway or Cork or Mayo or wherever. But I think by and large Ireland has embraced, so if the economic factors are a huge part of it, of course they are. And it wasn't a give me, you're poor, you're hungry message of, late 19th century United States. But at the same time, I think Ireland has largely embraced the change that has come with it. Because it does, you see it. Ireland is a more exciting place because of it. There are more, but yeah, the diversity is shaking us up a bit. and it's a good thing. And I say it's a lot better place than growing up in a homogenous 1980s Cork.
Ciarán, if we go back and clock out from our own history that is not necessarily Irish history, but on the American history, a lot of history will record that some of the prejudice, that some had to do with competition for jobs, for the Irish who came from from a history of oppression, famine, and all of the needs that we recognize, that actually a lot of the competition did breed prejudice, and it had very little to do with color. It had to do, with the fear that somebody would be breaking into what we thought was our area of progress and survival.
No, absolutely. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't give any credence to the kind of nonsensical idea that the indentured servants were the equivalent of slavery. But at the same time, if the freed men and women in the Northern United States in the 1840s and 50s were the bottom rung of the socioeconomic ladder, next rung up was probably the Irish. And of course, that would be competition. And there are two quotes from Frederick Douglass that kind of almost illustrate this. When he visited Ireland, he said, "One of the most pleasing features of my visit thus far has been the total absence of all manifestations of prejudice against me on account of my colour." So he was so pleased at a reception in Ireland. But then, about the Irish in America, he said, "Perhaps no class of our fellow citizens had carried this prejudice against colour to a point more extreme and dangerous than have our Catholic Irish fellow citizens." And he concludes that quote by saying, they are taught that he eats the bread that belongs to them. So what he's saying there, I suppose, is that competition was almost being planned by others as well. But there's no doubt that was at the root of a lot of prejudice and difficulty. And you look then at the draft riots during the Civil War, which are so kind of memorably recorded in Peter Quinn's novel, Banished Children of Eve. Yeah. So all that is there. Through the African-American Irish Diaspora Network and other initiatives, we have to explore all that and tease it out, as I say, take the bad with the good on it.
Yeah. And it sure beats cherry-picking.
Cherry-picking, of course, it's very easy for us to kind of look at some of Frederick Douglass's great quotes about being in Ireland and how wonderful he was received. But if you do that, you can't ignore what he said about the Irish in America. You have to take the whole. And it's the only way, that kind of honest exploration of it, is the only way we can move forward. And if I can drag that up for a moment, this year is the 150th anniversary of Douglas's visit to Ireland. This year is also the 150th anniversary of the 175th anniversary, excuse me. And it's also the 175th anniversary of the onset of the Great Famine in Ireland, which of course is transformational story of both Ireland and Irish America. It's the foundation, I suppose, really, of modern Irish America. So to take that as a starting point and to understand our history from then forward, and understand those histories in parallel and the intersections. But there's a lot of work and there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
And it's only worth doing if we do it in a serious way. But we can do so. And there's enough enthusiasm out there. And as you say, this work was underway before the murder of George Floyd and all that has followed from that, but maybe we capture the impetus that exists because of that and try to direct more energy into this work.
Well, we definitely know at several levels, and I don't know that this is peculiar to the Irish, but there are so many areas And indeed, we're pretty good at it ourselves when you, when, I don't know about Cork, but when we were growing up, there was little or no reference to the famine at all. It was, and that had to do more with the fact that, particularly up in our neck of the woods, there was survivor guilt that basically that tied with our religion. It was not a topic to be discussed. And they all lived happily ever after. There was a cut off there. And the excuse, perhaps it is indeed true, that at that period, we're talking about, you know, just 100 years after the famine. So it wasn't so much that it was a shameful topic, but rather one that came again with a lot of emotions, and the best way to deal with it, you know, was, you know, to say a prayer and move on.
Well, yes, Irish and the Irish and dealing with emotion, moving on is generally the best way. We were taught to deal with that. But you've done so much. I don't mean this as flattery, Adrian, but I mean it's actually you, along with partners, have done so much to bring the memory and the history of the famine alive in New York, including with the Great Hunger Memorial down in Battery Park City.
I'm very proud of it. But again, as you reacted in the beginning, that was I was one of so many people who, you know, felt that this was something that we should be doing, and from there it took off. The whole story of the famine, and as we saw, again, I've mentioned this many times before, that growing up in the national school in Ireland, the grammar school, our history, and Irish history in particular, brought us right up to about 1916, and then, if you went on to higher education, you'd learn about the rest of it. A lot of it did have to do with, became very personal, and you know, we could criticize the curriculum, what should have been, but it was all very understandable because of the times that were in it. It would be interesting as we move forward to see how differently the current situation is with diversity, how that is going to be handled now, because that also was kept on the back burner. So it's a new day, and perhaps long overdue. I thank you for joining us, and I still say that it was, and you're the first Consul General who actually, Irish Consul General here, who took the bull by the horns, when, in fact, it would be so much easier particularly coming up to St. Patrick's Day and the St. Patrick's Day parade, it would be a lot easier to focus on Irish history, on the St. Patrick's Day parade, the tie with the Catholic Church, all of that, which we had and still do, which is all great, but to bring that to the fore as part of a new recognition, existing part of the Irish traditions here, and to kind of make that Oscar and Doris open the door to take on a project like that, You're the one who made the tea, and your good wife made the sandwiches. So
well, like, as I say, there are plenty of others who were involved in this now, and plenty of others who've been doing this for a long time. But I thought it was important that official Ireland also come in and take some of the responsibility on this. And yeah, it's necessary work. And I started mentioning it a few times from various podiums at events, and all of a sudden will come and find you afterwards and say they want to be involved. People are excited by it, and they know it's necessary, and they know it's important. And hopefully we can do some good with it.
Yes, well, again, congratulations on the fact that there were so many areas. And I don't know, but as we look back on the council general, that indeed done such tremendous work, not only in New York, but throughout the United States. I think we will remember this particular year and this particular event as something that we won't forget anytime soon. Can I ask you, though, before we leave, about the tremendous work and the Irish government involvement in taking care of to a much higher level because of the coronavirus, the support of, say, Sláinte, the metal, and just about every area in our society that you know, that the Irish government is not just there in case. It is to the forefront in, again, providing tremendous services and support for those who really woke up one morning and their world had fallen apart.
Sláinte 2020 is a phenomenal initiative. It really is. The five organisations that have come together to run it. The Emerald, I probably forget one now, but the Ashland Irish Centre, the New York Irish Centre in Long Island City, the Emerald Isle Immigration Centre, the United Irish Counties Association, and New York GA have come together to support those who, as you say, their world fell apart when the COVID lockdown hit because their jobs were at an end and their income had dried up and they found themselves in dire straits. And the government have been, you know, I suppose, delighted, honoured to step in and give some financial support to Sláinte 2020 so that they can help others. And so, I mean, those five organisations, of course, are embedded in New York Irish society already.
Yeah.
They're embedded in the community. They understand the community. And we were delighted to be able to give them some assistance as they sought ways to help people at their quite possibly their lowest ebb. Individuals and families are being helped. We also gave some support to the Solid House, which of course is a counselling service because depending on people's support that people have around them, this can be a very challenging period for people's mental health. And there's been support in other cities as well, in Chicago, in Boston, I know of, I think possibly also in the Bay Area. I'm not sure about that. But look, the group that came together to set up and run Sláinte 2020 has done phenomenal work, necessary work, and it just again shows a phenomenal coming together of the Irish community for each other at a time of need in the city. I mean, I know before my time here there was Hurricane Sandy and the community came together.
Yeah.
This is the next big collective mail that people stand up for each other and with each other. And I just want to thank them for all the work they have done, and we hopefully can continue to support them.
I think it is fair, though, to point out that the Irish government was not sitting in the wings waiting for something as major and as horrific as this plague that hit us, because the tradition has been, you know, the Irish government, going back a couple of decades, have always not just given the the wink and the nod are the to those who are suffering, to the immigrants. They were particularly sensitive to the need to be there, not to be wait to be called upon, but to get behind.
Since 2015, the government, through the consulate, have given almost $4 million to welfare organizations in New York to support the community through the Immigrant Support Program. So it is long-standing support, and most of those organizations that I mentioned were already partners with us in supporting the community. But then, of course, when the need becomes more acute, we need to be able to act quickly, and luckily we were able to do so.
Kieran Madden, who is the Consul General of Ireland, and somebody indeed who is as handful as with a lot of the a great number of representatives of the Irish government. Thank you for being with us today, and also we have mentioned a couple of times Dr. Miriam Nyhan Gray, who again has made tremendous strides with, of course, her team at Glucksman Ireland House, and it has been a privilege for us for many years to actually have Dr. Miriam Ryan Gray with her own program here on Saturday mornings. It's tremendous, and we as we look forward and not sure what the new normal is, I think that the strength and the tradition, the metal tradition of the Irish getting together, to help the neighbor's child, is something that we can be very proud of. But for the Irish government and for the Irish government contribution, we are indeed most grateful, and thank you for continuing to do what is very necessary in tough times.
No, thanks for the warm welcome this morning, and we'll hopefully talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Stay safe.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. And friends there, the Consul General of Ireland, who's done such an amazing job and continues to do it. We are going to head over to Ireland in a couple of minutes now here to catch up with Kevin O'Connor with news and sports from Ireland. Okay, take a little music here from the harp concert, Carolyn's Concerto with Plansky. And let's go to Ireland, to Brownwood County Wicklow, and to Kevin O'Connor. Kevin, you're very welcome. How are things in Ireland?
Yeah, glorious sunny day here, and it's in the high 60s. Taoiseach calls for a boxing boycott following the involvement of an Irish drugs boss. Ireland has almost zero cases of COVID. Aer Lingus nears deal with unions. Monaghan Holyer faces 39 counts of manslaughter, and agreement on government expected this weekend. And these were some of the main stories, as Rory McIlroy is two shots adrift at the Charles Schwab challenge, and he had a 63 for a midway 9-under par total of 131, and he said just two shots adrift. The All-Ireland hurling and football finals will be played in 2020, with the potential of the football final being held on the weekend before Christmas. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has called for a boycott of a boxing world title fight amid controversy over the involvement of Irish drug kingpin Daniel Kinahan. The Taoiseach spoke out as respected boxing promoter Bob Arum from the States tried to play down the notorious Dublin gang boss's involvement in crime. It came as two major broadcasters moved to distance themselves from the bout dubbed the biggest fight in British boxing history, involving Anthony Joshua and Tyson Fury. U.S. boxing promoter Bob Arum said Kinahan's involvement with crime is not of a major concern for him. However, Mr. Varadkar said sports and media organizations should have nothing to do with the boxing showdown. Kinahan, who heads a cartel involved in murders both in Ireland and abroad, as well as a major drugs empire, was given a big shout-out earlier this week by Tyson Fury for his role in brokering the major bout with Anthony Joshua. Of course, the Ireland, remember, is boxing is Ireland's most successful international sport. More than half of Ireland's Olympic medals have come in boxing. No other sport has had as much success at European or world level as Irish boxing, amateur or professional. Ireland has almost zero new cases of COVID-19, and all indicators of the disease are either stable or declining. 3 weeks into the easing of restrictions, public health officials have said, vowing to go as low as we possibly can towards eliminating the disease, Chief Medical Officer Tony Holohan, Dr. Tony Holohan, said he did not believe there were hidden clusters out there separate from the small numbers of daily cases now being reported. Meanwhile, there may be some signs of the economy is creeping back into life after it experienced a severe COVID-related shocks that pushed it into the deepest recession on record. The Central Bank of Ireland's monthly business cycle indicator for April showed that the fall in economic activity was about twice as deep as the financial crisis. Aer Lingus will drop demand for further pay cuts and reverse planned temporary layoffs if staff agree to wide-ranging work practice changes. It has emerged news of a possible deal with unions came as details were revealed of Aer Lingus' plans to begin flying to Spain and several other European centres from July 1st as coronavirus travel bans ease. And the aircraft manufacturer Bombardier is to cut up to 600 jobs in its Northern Ireland operations, it said this week, as part of plans announced to cut 2,500 jobs of about 11% of the workforce in its global aviation unit. The cuts include 400 core workers and up to 200 workers from its the complementary labour force of temporary and agency workers, a Bombardier spokesman said. The United Union said it had been informed of plans to cut 600 positions. The alleged ringleader of an organised crime gang who is wanted to face manslaughter charges over the deaths of 39 migrants in a lorry container last year will be extradited to the UK next week after ordering his extradition to the United Kingdom. High Court Judge Mr. Justice Paul Burns said that Ronan Hughes, age 40, wants to be surrendered to authorities there as soon as possible. The judge ruled that the order will take effect next Monday. Hughes from Leitrim is suspected of being the ringleader of an organisation that trafficked the Vietnamese nationals and is wanted in the UK to face 39 counts of manslaughter. Finally, talks on a programme for government were continuing this weekend amid expectation that an agreement would be concluded over the weekend, but also growing frustration that a final text had not yet been signed up by the negotiators. Sources on all sides say that barring last-minute hiccups, there are no substantial policy disagreements standing in the way of an agreement to form a coalition government, though talks on the precise text of the programme for government, expected to run to over 100 pages, will continue today and tomorrow. Kevin O'Connor in Longwood, gloriously sunny, 65 degrees. Strong good Claire.
Kevin, thank you for that again. Any, by the way, that's tremendous news. That's great news. Indeed, with the coronavirus, the COVID-19, and the fact that it would appear that Ireland did the right thing in what many of those of us might have thought that very strict social distancing regulations and indeed travel. Now tell us about the travel restrictions with respect to where, what's the new, are there still restrictions for
the,
those who are driving?
The ones that came in last week are still there and they will be there until June 29 when we have restaurants will be open then, but they're hoping, of course, it won't be 2 meters, that it might be just 1 meter, but that hasn't been decided yet. It hasn't been, it's been agreed that it's 2 meters. Whether it's going to be 1 meter will affect up to 80,000 jobs, I'm told, that's why the government hasn't made a decision on that yet, which is very important.
Is there pressure on the government, and from what areas, with respect to the restrictions, particularly travelling outside, what was a 2 kilometre restriction in Ireland, which many would have thought was.
No, you can now travel within your county and or 25 kilometres. So the restrictions have more or less been lifted. But it will be completely lifted, I understand, on June the 29th.
Okay. Thanks again, Kevin
O'Connor. Okay.
Good luck to you. All right. Thanks for the news. And of course, here from our Kevin O'Connor. Okay, back on the turntable, let's hear from the McLean Avenue Band. I find that has made such tremendous strides in over the last couple of years. And McLean Avenue, as in McLean Avenue Yonkers, is another McNulty song, one made very famous by the McNulty family. Grown up with this, particularly in Irish America. Song goes by Nick.
My friends are standing on the quay in grief and sorrow frantic. I'm just about to sail away on the good ship John O'Leary. He anchors way in the gangways up, I'm leaving Tipperary. It's goodbye Nick, goodbye Pat, goodbye Kate and Mary. He anchors way in the gangways up, I'm leaving Tipperary. Now the sea is rising up, I have no more to say. I'm bound to the Antilles, 3,000 miles away. Then the ocean back, here I have, having fun and dating. Spot, the Burlington, where we catch up with Jacqueline Whelan.
My once in a lifetime, when I can experience
great venues in Ireland. Ireland famous, of course, initially started in Dublin, the cabarets, the variety shows, and for, I think it was maybe, it was initially geared towards tourism to Ireland, those who made looking for that bit of excitement. But it became very popular throughout Ireland, and I think we're hoping at least that will return, that will come back and soon. Okay, here's from the Braemar Rooms in Ireland, another venue for music and song, and also food and drink and camaraderie. Red Harley.
I often think of Ireland, that's where my folk are from. Though I have never been there, I feel I still belong. I picture in my mind's eye a countryside serene, her mountains and her valleys, her fields forever green. There were dark days in times of famine, times of grief, and to many distant countries would spread the Irish seed. Now that seed has grown to flower, ever mindful of its power, and the ocean separates us, these ties will ever last. So sing a song for Ireland, our mother and our home. She is always at the heart of us, wherever we may go. And whenever
you're hello. If you're depressed before we tuned into that song, then of course we can. That wouldn't have helped you much. But anyway, that was Red Hurley there with from Ireland with Love, song of immigration. I often think of Ireland. Now let us go to Origin Theatre and to indeed the artistic director, the founder of Origin Theatre, hailing from Limerick. We have, of course, George Heslin. George, you're very welcome.
Good morning, Adrian. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
You're more than welcome. Now, Bloomsday, my God, how do you take what indeed you have perfected over the years, this great celebration of James Joyce and Bloomsday here in New York City. But this year is very different. Perhaps talk about the last few years and your, you know, extreme involvement in making Bloomsday such a fixture, particularly in the New York area.
Yes, well, what happened, Adrian, was about 7 years ago, Origin, we did some research, and we discovered, actually, that there was no Bloomsday breakfast in New York City. So 7 years ago, in partnership with Bloom's Tavern on 58th Street, Origin launched New York's only Bloomsday breakfast, and we call it Origins. This year's our seventh year. So it's a costumed event at Bloom's Tavern on 58th Street, where about 200-250 of our patrons come, and everybody is dressed in full costume every year, and we have Best Dress Pride. We are, Bloom's Tavern offers free breakfast, free Irish breakfast. And then we go on the journey of Ulysses with about 20 of New York's favorite Irish actors and musicians. And like I said, this event normally takes place at Bloom's Tavern on 58th Street, but this year, it's actually going to be online on Tuesday, June 16th at 11 a.m. at origintheatre.org. So we have a wonderful host of talent lined up from all sorts of walks of life, great, great talented people, you know, including writers, musicians, actors, performers, raconteurs like Malachy McCourt.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking forward to putting all this online this year. So we're actually in the editing suite all weekend, working on it to launch it on Tuesday.
Now, what's happening tomorrow? I know you have something lined up for tomorrow too.
No, what's lined up for tomorrow is there's originally we were going to do it on Sunday. Was meant to be on Sunday, but then because of we were able to broadcast through the website, we've moved it to the actual June 16th itself.
Oh.
So normally we would have done it on the Sunday, but then we've moved it this year to Tuesday because obviously it's going to be online, you know?
So, yeah, so it's actually, we can scrap this. I was going to give a great big build-up thanks to your friend and, you know, our producer here, Ony Sheridan, focusing on, is here underlined, you know, Sunday. Okay, Sunday. So actually, it's all happening on Tuesday. Just, can you give us a little background, you know, on Joyce and bringing back to 1980, the image, America not exactly reaching out for this scoundrel, this person who, you know, thought vulgarity was tremendous and could do without it. Just bring us back to that period.
Yeah, well, Joyce is one of our most beloved writers in Ireland, and he really pushed the boundaries in terms of writing and style. You know, and the book Ulysses, of course, takes place in 1904, when we go on an imaginary journey through Dublin, through some of the most famous iconic locations in Dublin. And Leopold Bloom takes the journey, meeting a host of characters from across Ireland, across Dublin. And this year we have some fabulous writers. We have Colin McCann joining us and Colin Broderick and Sy Walsh. And also we have some of our great actors here in New York, including Terry Donnelly, Rosemary Fine, Malachy McCourt, Daniel Shea, Paul and Nance, Fiona Walsh, and of course a host of musicians as well, bringing us some music of the time. So we're very much looking forward to it. And also what's great, Adrian, about going online is, of course, we can now share the experience with an international audience as well, you know?
And that's Well, first of all, it's new. Did we ever think it would come in as handy as it is now?
Yes, indeed. Did we ever imagine a year ago we'd be here with COVID-19?
Oh, boy. So now, the breakfast, how does one have breakfast online?
Well, how you have breakfast online is we happily provide the free entertainment. Like I say, we have about 22 artists this year. And you can get up with yourself and you can cook your own breakfast in the best way possible. And if you want to, you can even Google a Bloomsday breakfast online, so you can get the kidneys and the liver. You can get all the ingredients beforehand, and you can make your own private party at home on Tuesday, June 16th.
That's amazing. But had you, you know, the social media, which to me and those in my age group, that the power of social media was not strange at all to our set. I mean, you didn't wait for the coronavirus to hit. You had done pretty much a lot of headway through social media.
Yes, yeah, we have been putting, you know, for the last number of years, we have been putting the live event online as well through Facebook Live. So that has garnered a large audience of supporters as well, you know. But I mean, it's just so great that what we can do. And also the lovely thing is, you know, about when you record these, they live on forever as well, you know, on our YouTube channels and on our website, you know. So even throughout the year, if people want to join us or if people miss the 11 o'clock start time on Tuesday, you can just go back and the video will remain active for quite a long time, which is great. But yeah, the social media really, I mean, we were so prepared in some ways for COVID-19 to be able to all work from home, those of us that are lucky enough. You know, but I mean, I think what's been very challenging in certainly from the artists that we're working with, the artistic community has been very impacted by COVID-19. And it was so lovely to just in creating Bloomsday to bring our community back together, for one-off events, you know, because, you know, there's a big challenge ahead for theater and theater companies. Although Origin now as well, we've also commissioned 4 new writers to write plays on domestic abuse. We've commissioned Derek Murphy and Honor Malloy, who are in New York, and Ursula Rana Sarma and Geraldine Aaron, who are both Irish playwrights living in London. So we're also making those projects at the moment as well, which we're working with a film company on them, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're certainly trying to work with the platform that's provided for us. You know, I think for theaters, we're going to be in this situation for at least a year, I would say, you know? Who knows? We hope at least only a year, you know?
Hope. Not only Origin Theatre, but we also know, of course, our friends at the Irish Repertory Theatre have become, you know, a dab hand and from very short notice of a whole new medium. How do you take, you know, the established works, the works that we associate with stage, with the presentation, the live performing presentation of some of the greatest works, Irish works, which is what the Irish Repertory Theatre specializes in. But how do you, you know, again, as artistic director, when you sit down to, you know, reimagine, to recreate, as it were, you know, to have actors again live, you know, doing pretty much what would be difficult enough on stage, never mind.
Well, I think it's a challenge, you know. I mean, we're obviously all trying to learn these new platforms and stuff, but I do think, you know, ultimately we do want to get back, and I'm sure the Irish Rep feel the same, but ultimately they want to open their doors and get back to live theatre. So there's most definitely, and I think certain plays are more suited, Adrian, to these platforms than every play, you know. Like, I would imagine a comedy would be very, very difficult, for instance, to
to put online and stuff. So, I mean, you know, people are managing in some ways by selecting work that does work on various platforms. But it is a challenge. And also, you know, we're not film companies. And, you know, let's be honest, Netflix and production companies do it really well. So I think what we're trying to do is to find our voice within there somewhere. And, of course, the cost of filming as well is very, very expensive for companies. You know, it's a whole other budget line as well, you know, but we're trying to adapt slowly, and hopefully, you know, I mean, there's a point as well, I think, a tipping point where I think we feel that, you know, people will have enough, particularly coming into the summer, that people will have enough of sitting in front of computers and want to get on with their lives in the outdoors, you know. So, I mean, so I think we're trying to be strategic as well in how we plan and run things for a certain number of performances, because of course we have to work within union guidelines as well, you know, But it's great for the actors who do get these opportunities to work on these new platforms. Yeah, but we look forward to the day when we can all convene again in theatre spaces, you know?
Yeah. George has an artistic director, friends. I just want to ask you, though, and I'm sure it is, many would wonder how are those in the theatre, how are you getting through this? Where's the funding? What's your approach and what's your outreach to supporters?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question, Adrian. I mean, you know, the truth is our event that we're showing on Tuesday night is a free event, and we are hoping that people will make a donation before, during, or after. And a donation of any amount really does help defray the cost in terms of the project, you know. But we are, I think we're coming to the end of our tax year. As a theatre company, the end of our year is June 30th. Mm. So we're getting near the end of this year, June 30th. So then we go into a whole new cycle of funding, etc., from city and state, etc. So we are waiting to hear we are aware that all of our grants are going to be cut, basically. It depends on the size of the organization, how much we will lose, etc. So we are very much, you know, ramping up our fundraising towards individuals. We'll definitely have to take place. And also for those who really have stood by the company, you know, we hope that people will give a little bit more. We're also aiming to do our gala. Our gala was due to be in May, and we've moved that to Monday, October 19th, at Mutual of America on Park Avenue. So we're hoping as well that we can carry out our gala by that time. We hope we'll be in a safer environment with social distancing, etc. But no, it's a lot for the theatre sector, Adrian. I mean, I've heard of numerous companies already closing down, and you know, a lot of venues around town that have closed as well, and some quite established places, you know. So I think the landscape that we're coming out of and coming out to in the coming months will be a very, very different New York from the theatre point of view. You know, Broadway has no plans to open right now. Our tourism sector is obviously impacted. And as you look at the streets of New York, there seems to be so few people who are here at this time.
Right.
So, you know, hopefully they'll all be at home watching Bloomsday on June 16th.
Well, we hope so as well. Give that information again. I think that what we're all realizing and what we're dealing with, some areas it jumps out at all of us. Oh my God, they probably need support. They need support today. The whole notion of theatres, and particularly with the focus on all theatres in New York closing down, we don't see that as something that obviously needs our support. We kind of say, well, when it opens up again, we'll definitely support it. That's not doing anybody much good now. And I was delighted that you did say, small amount, whatever the amount of support, they add up, but also the lack of support, and as you pointed out, like waiting for grants and for subsidies that are going, we have no idea how much they're going to be slashed. But make it easy for us and for those who are listening and say, oh my God, I didn't think of that. I thought to be the theatre would be very nice. Thank you. They shut off the lights and whenever it opens up, we'll be fine. Again. So just tell us, in the absence of, say, for the theatre, where you know, a lot of the those and our friends in theatre are have a great support base, but many might think, well, okay, we pick that up again, you know, as soon as this is over. Tell us about that aspect of it.
Well, I mean, the truth is, you know, like all companies, even though our doors are shut to audiences at the moment, we still have running costs, we still have all our staff. Fortunately, at Origin, we did not have to leave any of our staff go at this time, which is an achievement in itself. So, yeah, you still have running costs. And, of course, for a theatre company, you know, a lot of our income does come from footfall and from ticket sales, you know. So when, you know, the danger, I suppose, as well, is, you know, so many events are free online at the moment that, I suppose the long-term challenge is as well that you're educating audiences that, oh, entertainment is free, is free. So, you know, I think we're going to, for me, when we open our doors again, it'll be interesting to see, you know, will people be willing to cough up certainly $65 or $75 to come see a production when they've been so used to viewing stuff online. So I think we're going to hit another kind of conversation that's going to have to go around that about the value of the arts to community and to society, you know. But I do think that, you know, what we're going through, we will get through it. But, you know, that there are still a lot of costs in keeping operations going. There's no doubt about that, you know. But we will get through it. And also the lovely thing about theatre is people kind of reimagine. Like we're actually, Origin also runs the first Irish Festival in January. And next January, we've actually commissioned 50 playwrights. We're commissioning 50 writers to write monologues about the Irish-American experience. And we're hoping, even if we have small social distancing audiences in January, that we're hoping to do these projects all across the city in unique spaces. And there might be only one person in the audience, there might be five people in the audience, but we're determined to make the festival happen again in January in a very safe environment, working within CDC and city and state guidelines. But you know, the artists will work around this, and, you know, they're ready to get back to work.
Well, okay. And it's great, the determination, and, you know, being able to adjust to what is basically, you know, a livelihood. This is not something that you add on as a hobby. This is a business.
No, I mean, you know, the statistics are that, you know, theatre, after Wall Street, theatre is the second biggest industry in New York City, second or third. So theatre is a big driving economic force. Like when you look at a Monday night in New York and a regular Monday, you know, when Broadway is closed, New York is very quiet. And I think we had a Broadway strike. There was a musician strike about 14 years ago. It went on for about 12 weeks. And something like,
I remember,
you know, the city lost something like $16 billion in that time. So theatre is a big economic driver in terms of filling hotels, restaurants, bars. So I'm sure other business one theaters open their doors as well, so the knock on effect and how they get support from it as well.
Okay, Tuesday coming up, what time does it start?
So it's at origintheater.org and it's 11 a.m. on Tuesday, June 16th, and it's live on our website and it's free of charge, and of course we would love as many donations as possible.
And again, you know, to do that, it's origintheater.org.
Yeah, and I want to say thank you as well, Adrian, to all of the artists who have been involved. We have great musicians as well, like Alan Cogarty, Mary Courtney, Mia Pyland, Owen Cannon, Gregory Harrington. So we have exceptional people. So I want to say thank you to all of the artists who have given their time and services, and we really, really appreciate that.
All good. Thank you, George Huston, there, friends, who is the artistic director. The artistic director of Origin Theatre, and an amazingly successful track record and again headed up by George Husband. But they've just done so much, and the undertaking of George Husband coming, not just to bring Irish writers and artists and playwrights, but to reach further as he has done, and very successfully, to bring the theatre and the talent of Europe, and to bring it to New York and have it as successful as it is. All right, it's origintheatre.org, origintheatre.org. And that kind of brings us, friends, to the end of a program. And again, let me just rattle off a couple of the artists and actors who are participating with in Origin Theatre's, you know, the Bloomsday on Tuesday, which again starts at 11 o'clock. You know, Colin Broderick, Una Clancy, Gina Costigan, Terry Donnelly, Rosemary Pine, Sean Gormley, Kate Kenneth, just Colin McCann, of course, Malachy McCourt, you know, Brendan Meaney. It's just so many, and again, it has all the semblance of being, you know, a very entertaining and indeed keeping the tradition alive of celebrating Bloomsday right here in New York City. Okay, for Kieran Madden, Consul General of Ireland, and his own, well, first of all, I want to thank him for, you know, for his participation. It was great work, and not just, you know, for his for the Irish government support, you know, of the Irish, particularly during this time here. They've been doing this for a long time, and we're absolutely delighted, indeed, that you know, that the continuing support of the Irish government is very much alive and that is there. And also, to Kieran in particular, the African American Irish Diaspora Network, which indeed was launched in the Irish Consulate again in February, that's before the coronavirus. And it gave birth to, or it solidified that a topic and an area that heretofore has been you know, considered to be a scholastic exercise. Great stuff. To all of you, friends, we hope that you have enjoyed the program, and that this week, and as we head into the future, that things will get better by the day, and much more important than all of that is that, yes, we're committed to getting through this. Anytime, anywhere, irishradio.com, if you want to send us an email, make that Aine, A-I-N-E, at irishradio.com. Aine Sheridan, myself, Adrian Flannery, says so long. God bless, and thank you for listening.